Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of the show, we'll be talking a bit about what research is being done in the field of cognitive neuroscience. And this is an area that examines what sensory input actually does in terms of our functioning of our brain, memory, perception, awareness, a variety of things that hopefully we all use every day. Science is looking at how these things actually function to try to understand how they work and perhaps what goes wrong when they don't work, and a variety of other things pertaining to the way that we think and function as hopefully intelligent human beings. We'll talk with our guest, Marta Kutis. She is a professor in the departments of cognitive science and neurosciences at the University of California at San Diego. She's visiting Champaign-Urbana to give a lecture in the Center for Advanced Study Millicom series. This is also the annual Lyle Lanier lecture that happens on the campus here once a year. That lecture is tonight at 8 p.m. at the Beckman Institute Auditorium, and we'll get a little preview of the subjects that she'll cover tonight during this hour of the show. Marta Kutis is a leading expert in the field of cognitive neurosciences, and she is also a graduate of the University of Illinois. As I mentioned, she's currently in the Department of Cognitive Science and Neurosciences at the University of California at San Diego, where she has been teaching since 1990. She is widely published. She has served as president of the Society for Psychophysiological Research, and her interests are human cognition and neuropsychology, a number of things pertaining to attention and memory and sleep, a wide variety of things that we may be able to talk about during this hour. I'll try to ask some dumb guy questions, and we'll go from there. Your questions are welcome as well. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Professor Kutis, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I hardly know where to begin, except maybe to ask, how do you study what's happening in the brain? What are you looking at?
Well, the way that there are many ways that people can do it, of course, and no one is better than any other. In fact, I'm a firm believer that you have to look at it as many ways as possible, because any one particular way only gives you a part of the information. So there's no one way that reveals all the secrets. But the way I do it is by putting electrodes onto the scalp of people and recording their brainwave activity. So we're essentially looking at what you would think of as EEG, the electroencephalogram. So the electrical activity that's generated by the brain as you're doing everything and anything, because as most people know, insofar as they hear about EEG, the way they tend to hear about it is on hospital shows. They know that one of the things that happens if you have brain damage or if there's a concussion or anything, you get rushed to the hospital and they look at your EEG because they want to know if you're alive. In fact, when they talk about brain dead, that's essentially what they're looking at. Is it a flat line in the brain activity, or is there activity, you know, is it fluctuating? If it's fluctuating, then chances are that the brain is still alive. And if you look at it under systematic conditions, then you can actually read those brain waves to get a sense of what's going on in the brain. Now, what I don't mean, however, is read the mind, per se. I don't really know what people are thinking.
What do the brain waves, when you read them, what do they indicate? Obviously, activity. But are there ways to discern? We know certain regions of the brain do certain things. I mean, what do they tell us?
Well, the way that on the one hand, you're simply just looking at the activity of neurons talking to each other, because the way that neurons talk to each other is electrochemically, okay? And you can't really look at the brain waves in general without any context and know exactly what's going on, other than to say you might be able to tell that the person's awake or that the person's asleep, or if they're thinking or if they're relaxing. You know, people know about the alpha state, for example. So you can look at the frequency of the brainwave activity and get some indication of what state the person is in. But if you're interested in actually looking at information processing, so you're interested in looking at how the brain deals with particular types of sensory inputs or how a person prepares to make a movement of the body, then you can look at part of the brain waves that are actually synchronized in time, temporally locked to some event, where the event is something that an experimenter has presented. So I can present you with a word. I can, you know, click my fingers. If I can have an event like that, and then I can look at a little segment of the brain activity that is actually locked in time to that, average across many such segments. So, you know, perhaps present you with 30 words and average them. What I get is this voltage waveform in time. And, you know, it goes – some places it goes negative. Some places it goes positive. So we have – it can vary in its polarity. It can vary in the time after the event. So I can look at it 1 millisecond after, 10 milliseconds after, 30 milliseconds after, you know, a half a second after, and so on. And if I put electrodes all over your head, so many different locations, then I can look at the spatial distribution of this activity. Now, if you do that in two different conditions, so let's say I do that in one condition where all of the words are actually words that you know, and I do this in another condition where they're words you don't know, or they're not even words, but maybe they could be words. Now I can get an average of this waveform for the words. I can get an average for the non-words. I can now compare the two of them. Okay, literally put them on top of each other. And I can look, where's the first point in time where I see a difference? Because up to the point where I see a difference, I don't see a difference. Okay, before that, you would say, well, I guess the brain's treating them similarly. I mean, you could always argue that maybe the technique isn't sensitive enough. But if we grant that, then up to some point, they're similar. So up to that point, the brain seems to be treating them differently, similarly. At some point, they diverge. When these waveforms diverge, you know by this time the brain somehow must have appreciated some difference between them. Mm-hmm. And then, so at minimum, you've got this latency, this time, and you can say, oh, it takes the brain 100 milliseconds to do this or 300 milliseconds to do this. So that would be, for example, one finding that you could do. Mm-hmm. Then you could do something like say, well, I wonder what happens if I take these same words, but I put a mask in front of them, something to make it harder, you know, like a screen door, you know, so it's harder to look through. Now you know it's going to be harder to read that. Is that now going to delay when you can first see this difference? Or is it going to affect something else? Maybe it'll affect some part of the waveform even earlier. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's only going to affect a part of the waveform later. Or maybe it's going to affect it earlier, and that is going to then have a secondary consequence of changing also when the two diverge. So it's what you do is you set up experimental conditions in which you manipulate what a person is seeing or hearing or feeling. I mean, by, you know, touch. And you have multiple conditions like that. You get these multiple waveforms, and you believe that you've varied a particular aspect of it, of the situation. And then you look to see, is the brain sensitive to it? If it's sensitive to it, when is it sensitive to it? How is it sensitive to it? And once you find something that it's actually sensitive to, then you can manipulate other aspects that psychologists or sociologists or clinical psychologists, depending on what the question is, say is important or not important for that particular phenomenon, for that particular decision. And then you look to see, are they right or wrong? And then you can test theories because, of course, different psychologists have very different theories about how things work.
Well, that was the next area I was going to ask about, because presumably when you're doing experimental science, you're testing it against some theory. And I guess the only theory I know about the brain, quite frankly, to be honest, is, and I think it's been, from what I hear, also disputed, the left brain, right brain hypothesis that, you know, certain, you know, the left brain handles mathematical, logical operations, and the right brain handles creative kinds of work. and a very simplistic, perhaps, notion of a theory. Are there theories? What are the theories about, for example, you know, what memory is and what understanding is? Are we at the point where we even have theories for these things?
Whoa. Well, that was a difficult question to answer. Probably I should say, to do justice to all of the people in the different fields out there, of course there are theories about all of those things.
Yeah.
My concern usually is, are they testable? Mm-hmm. And are they testable with the particular methods that I know how to use?
Yeah.
At that level, it's very difficult to really specify any given theory. I mean, none of them are specified in such detail that they're easy to test, first of all. Secondly, most of the time, despite the fact that you know, when you get into science, you're very interested in general questions, you know, like you want to know, well, you know, what is awareness or what is consciousness? But you find that as soon as you do research, it's impossible to design a question, an experiment that's going to address that general of a question. What you end up asking are very specific, very, in some sense, small and almost boring questions, but that's what it takes. I mean, so the sort of example that I gave you of the word versus non-word, you know, think, oh, wow, I mean, who cares? But put into the larger picture of things, you have to understand some of those before you can get to some of the larger questions. That said, boy, theories. The sorts of differences I think that we tend to look at, particularly because one of the good things that you can use brainwaves for is looking at the timing of brain activity and the timing of differences, you know, where somebody says this is the same as that. Okay, so for example, you might think that when you try to make sense of a word in context, okay, in the context of a sentence, mm-hmm. that whatever process you go through in order to understand a written word should be the same process that you go through to understand a spoken word, and in fact may even be the same process that you go through when you look at a picture to understand what it represents as a concept. Because in all cases, you're trying to get at a concept.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, that may be one use of language. So the question is that the case? Are there similar processes regardless of how the information went in? Okay, and so one set of theories will say, yes, there is this area of common sense, this amodal area where meaning is represented, okay? So there's this particular site in the brain, and that's where meaning is. So if you zap that site, that's it. You wouldn't be able to understand anything. You wouldn't be able to understand a word, no matter how it came into you or to see a picture, okay? Another group of people will say, no, that doesn't make any sense at all. It's true that there's some similarity in the process, but there's no one single area that you can zap that has meaning in it, but meaning is the integrated activity in all of these different areas.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you hear a word, then, you know, areas that deal with auditory inputs tend to light up. And when you see a word, then areas that have, you know, mostly visual inputs processing, they light up. When you see a picture, it's yet different areas, okay? And those are very different views. And that's the sort of distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even that one's not so easy to answer. But I believe that the data go more in the line of it's sort of scattered all over the brain than any one location, though there may be still overlap. And that's the sort of theorizing that we tend to look at.
Okay. So you're trying to measure activity in various parts of the brain based on certain stimulations of, you know, that you can control.
Yes, but we're not specifically with the methodology that I've talked about,
yeah.
which is brainwaves, interested in localization. So we don't look at the pattern and say, oh, it's going on here versus going on there. Rather, what we tend to say is, if the two that you're comparing, you know, this pattern and that pattern, are not the same, okay, regardless of how they're not the same in terms of their pattern across the scalp, you know the different brain areas have been activated, or even if it were the same brain area, they'd have to be activated very differently. So if you wanted to do localization, if you simply were interested in where is it going on the whole, brain waves are not the way that you would do it.
Okay. I understand. The brain waves simply measure the amount of electrical activity? Amplitude, voltage?
They certainly give you amount. And insofar as the patterns differ across the head, you know that different areas are involved. And you often use them to so you can use it, different patterns. There's a difference between saying, yes, they're different, versus being then able to say, well, the difference is because of X,
Right. Okay,
that particular area. That information has to come from some other methodology.
Okay. Well, we have one caller to bring in the conversation, and let me just reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Marta Kutis. She's a professor in the Departments of Cognitive Science and Neurosciences at the University of California at San Diego, and she's here to give a lecture in the Millicom series, also the Lyle Lanier Lecture, tonight at 8 o'clock at the auditorium at the Beckman Institute in Urbana, and that is open to the public if you'd like to attend. The lecture title is From Senses to Sense, an Electrophysiological View on the Human Brain Activities. We're talking about some of that during this hour. We have one caller, would welcome others. If you'd like to join us, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Bloomington, Indiana, on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I want to know, what is the actual value of the electric current which operates the brain? If the brain were a 60-watt light bulb, it would consume about 1/2 watt. I'm sorry, 1/2 amp of current, and that current would be driven by 115 volts. What kind of amperage are we talking about in the brain, and what kind of voltage drives it?
Well, I can tell you in terms of voltages, we're talking about we're talking about, on the average, if you were recording on the scalp, the particular components of the waveform are in microvolts. So we're talking between...
Millions of volts.
Pardon?
Millions of volts.
Yes, very small. Very, very small. Relative to, I mean, we're talking about maybe a 10 microvolt signal on the average.
Wow. Well, and you're now, is this the voltage that the sensor itself is picking up, or is this the voltage that is actually operating within the brain?
Because the sensor is picking up the voltage that is actually what is being generated by the brain. Current flows in the brain. Ions move across cell membranes with stimulation. And that generates current flow.
It generates a magnetic field, doesn't it?
Yes, in fact, you could have magnetic sensors on the outside, and there are people who are just as interested in recording the magnetic activity as they are interested in recording the electrical activity.
That's a different measure entirely.
It's a different measure, but it has very similar characteristics in terms of the type of questions that you can ask and the type of information. It looks at a slightly smaller subset of the activity. So you have to have the neurons oriented in a particular when activated in a particular way relative to the scalp in order to actually be able to pick them up. So it's best for a certain part of the activity in the brain, but you can record the magnetoencephalogram as easily as you can record the electroencephalogram with different equipment, of course.
Now when you actually, those sensors, those probes that you put on the scalp, you say they are actually picking up a real electric current.
They're not imposing any current. No, they're amplifying current.
They're amplifying a magnetically based signal, aren't they? In other words, the neurons in the brain are passing electric current.
Yes.
That electric current is creating a magnetic field around it.
Yes.
And the probes are picking up that magnetic field. That magnetic field induces a current into those probes, and that's the current that's amplified. And that's what you see on your scope, isn't it? Do you follow? Do you follow what I'm saying? Any time you have an alternating electric current of any kind, there's a magnetic field produced around that.
Yes, current. There is a magnetic field that's produced around it, and you can pick that up with with magnetic, with sensors that are sensitive to that magnetic field. You can also pick up the electrical activity directly.
Oh, you can.
Yes.
Oh, that's very interesting. In other words, the electrical activity that's going on in the brain is passing right through the scalp.
Yes, it is.
Oh my goodness.
It's much attenuated. So if you were actually recording on the cortical surface, then you'd be seeing millivolts. Okay?
Wow.
So it's microvolts at the level of the scalp
because
it goes through several layers and it's smeared. And it's attenuated. In fact, that's why we need amplifiers to make them bigger so we can actually see them. And it's also the reason why we can't actually see the response to just a single word easily, because it's embedded in the EEG and it's very difficult to see. Rather, we have to have multiple presentations of similar events, average across them, so that the EEG that's not time-locked to that presentation averages out, and then what you get is this waveform, which is at the level of microvolts.
How interesting. What a good program.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call. To actually measure inside the scalp, inside the skull, would be a little bit more invasive.
Right. Well, it does happen for individuals who may have epilepsy, for example, that's intractable to various types of medicines, to various drugs. I mean, your first attempt is to deal with it that way, but sometimes that doesn't work. And so there are neurosurgeons who open up, part of the skull and lower electrodes into single units. And, at that point you can record off the scalp. I mean, I'm sorry, off the cortex.
Right. Okay. In these ways, can we actually measure thinking, what's going on with thought patterns?
Well, not stated that way.
Okay.
I think that it sort of depends on what you mean by thinking.
Okay.
You can.
I think I don't know what I mean by thinking. I mean, this is one of the questions: what actually happens when, this wonderful summary of your research interests mentions these very large issues. How is knowledge represented in the brain? How is meaning represented? How do you measure those things? How do you go about getting to those big questions?
Okay. Well, when we first started to look at this, one of the sort of simple things that we did, and it's a minimal step in that direction, but was to say, well, if you're interested in looking to see if there's a way to understand meaning and how it's processed by the brain, maybe what we can do is set up an experiment where we ask people to comprehend sentences, because we know that in order to listen to something or to read something, you're trying to make sense of it. I mean, it's just a bunch of squiggles on a piece of paper, black, red, whatever color, or when you're getting sound, it's just, it may be speech once you figured out what it is, but it's just sound, right? So your brain has to do something to make sense of it. Well, let's see what happens if we have sentences that are perfectly reasonable and you can understand versus ones where we throw in a word which makes it incomprehensible. So many years ago, we decided, well, this was work that I did with Steve Hilliard when I was a postdoc. And we started out by saying, let's see what happens if we compare the brain's response to a sentence like, I take coffee with cream and sugar, versus I take coffee with cream and dog. Dog obviously doesn't fit into the context of that sentence. It's meaningless. Okay? So can we look to see, is there a different brainwave that you get to dog versus sugar? And the answer is yes. Okay, so that's your first step. Now you've got something that you can work with, and you can say, okay, well, what does it look like? What's this difference? When does it occur? Well, within 250 milliseconds, okay? So within a quarter of a second, following the presentation of the word dog or sugar, the brain responses to them differentiate. Now, it doesn't mean that that's exactly the time point when the brain first figured it out. Maybe it figured it out earlier, but it certainly figured it out by that time, because you've got this difference telling you that's the case. Now you can see, okay, well, is it the same if I do it, as I was saying before, written? Yes. Is it the same if I do it in sign language? You know, what if we had people signing with their fingers, but the sign made sense or it didn't? Again, same thing. What if you do it spoken? Same thing. What if you throw in a picture into the middle of the sentence where the picture doesn't make sense? You know, you've got a picture of a dog at the end of that sentence. Again, same thing. Now, they're not exactly the same, which means that you know, there's slight differences in terms of where on the head it's big, but the pattern of what the brain's response looks like to something that makes sense versus the response to something that doesn't make sense looks very similar regardless of the modality of the input. So it's telling you we're looking somehow at the processing of meaning. Mm-hmm. Now you can begin to say, okay, I've got this response. Now what can I do with it? Like, will it matter if I switch languages? Okay, so you're speaking along in English. All of a sudden, now a word doesn't make sense, but it's in Spanish. Well, if you happen to know Spanish and it's a good language for you, that also pops it off, and it's very similar, okay? So you can now, in fact, potentially you could, if you're interested in things about bilingualism and how bilinguals make sense, you can manipulate the type of words that you use. Maybe you can use words that are the same word in English and in Spanish, so cognates. Or, you know, there are many different sorts of things like that that you can do. Or maybe you're saying, well, okay, sense, nonsense. I mean, those are very extremes. Most of the time, the things that we hear are sensible. So what if we, you know, we're not just, maybe this is something special. And what you can the sorts of experiments that we've done over the years is to show that even if I had a sentence like I take coffee with cream and milk, which is not what you expect to hear, but it's understandable, okay? So the brain gives you this intermediate response. It's not the same as sugar, but it's not the same as dog either. It's somewhere in between. And the fact that it's in between tells you that there's this sort of range in which you're looking at, you know, it's the same sort of processing for meaning, but it actually matters what that word is. Mm-hmm. And it matters, you know, in terms of its frequency and it just aspects of the words. And you can begin to find out, well, what are the aspects that are important?
In terms of meaning and non-meaning.
Yeah, well, and just the difference between having, like if I had said, I take coffee with cream and saccharin, okay? Now, that's not sugar, okay? But saccharin is certainly meaning, at some level of meaning, very similar to sugar. So, again, would they be identical or are they slightly different? And is saccharin closer to the response of sugar than if I had put milk? Okay?
Right.
You can begin to manipulate what you believe meaning to be, the various features of words, and you can see which are the ones that are important or not.
We have another call to talk with. Let's include them and then we'll continue talking. By the way, our guest this morning is Marta Kutis. She is a professor of cognitive science and neurosciences, University of California at San Diego. We're talking about some of the research being done in her field. And callers are welcome. We had one person waiting. Others can call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, or toll-free anywhere, 800-222-9455. This is a listener in Clinton, Indiana, on line number 4. Good morning.
Good morning. See, I was wondering if she, or the guest there, can answer a question about electroshock treatment. or when you're like a nervous breakdown or something. I knew a woman, lived with her for about 11 years, but finally I couldn't take it no more. It never seemed to do her any good. She was about 6 months in the institution. But anyways, I'll just hang up and listen to your comment.
Okay. Well, is that something that you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it certainly is the case that the electrical, the brain works, you know, in terms of electrical signals. I mean, that's how it communicates, sort of electrochemically. And so, you know, something like epilepsy is actually abnormal firing sort of spontaneously in certain locations. And, you know, you can imagine that, you know, if you send if you send in a signal at the wrong point, mm-hmm. since the electrical signal is what the brain is using to make sense, I mean, in order to function, it's going to be a problem. There are, you know, there is some evidence that you can sort of zap the system with electroconvulsive therapy, with shock, and that for, in some sense, to reset parts of the system, to sort of almost zero it out and get it to work better. I mean, in some sense, it's no different than, you know, if the heart has stopped beating, mm-hmm. and then you zap it a little bit, you juice it, and it starts to go. For some people, it works. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are negative consequences, unfortunately. It makes it more difficult. You know, sometimes the memories that the person had around the time, right before the shock and around the time of the shock, are gone. And in some sense, that also is not surprising, because somehow it's that electrical activity that's going on in the brain that has to hold on to the memories that you have. It isn't always going to help with everybody. It sort of depends on the type of problems that they have. But so for some people, it's good. For some people, it doesn't work as well.
Okay. Well, thanks for that answer. We have another call. I promise I'll get right to them. But just, you know, what you said sort of brought to mind the question of memory and what it consists of. Is, in fact, memory an electrical signal in the brain? I mean, are you getting at some of those sorts of issues as well in your research?
Yes. Well, the problem with the difficulty of answering that question, at least as it was phrased, is that there is no such thing as memory. And by which I mean that, I mean, this is always what scientists do, of course. They analyze everything to death and they break it into its little pieces, but sometimes to good. There are many different types of memory, and those different types of memory are organized or within your brain in different ways. Mm-hmm. So, for example, at some level, there's evolutionary memory. You know, so it's in our genes. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's sort of a skeletal coding system there that determines the fact that we become humans and not, you know,
tomatoes,
salamanders,
yeah, right.
And so at some level, that's memory. You know, it's a very long-term evolutionary memory. It will determine sort of the basic organization of everybody's brain. Mm-hmm. And so there's also memory in the actual structure, the anatomical structure. You know, I mean, visual areas are where visual areas are supposed to be, and auditory areas are where auditory areas are supposed to be, at least as long as development is relatively normal. Okay, so there's memory actually in the anatomy, in the organization of the brain. At the same time, the brain it can be modified with use. So the nature of the connections, you know, I mean, the structure of your brain and the structure of my brain, at some level, they're very similar. But at another level, sort of at the level of, if we look at the, you know, our hands and we look at our prints, fingerprints, they're different.
Right.
Okay. Well, that's equally true of our brains. The experiences you've had in your life have molded your brain, and the experiences I've had have molded my brain. And those are different, and they've molded them in different ways. Mm-hmm. So they're different in terms of the connections that are there. And so they're different in how those connections, in some sense, are used, okay, the wiring at a very fine level is very different. And there's memory in that type of wiring. Mm-hmm. Then there's also, you know, so we have the very, very long-term memory. We have the sort of that's in your DNA. There's the sort of less long-term that's in the sort of structure, because it's there, but it's also plastic. Mm-hmm. Then there's also memory that's actually, you know, much shorter term. I mean, the sort of memory that you go and you look up the telephone number in the book, and what do? You keep saying it to yourself, and if somebody says anything, it's gone. Okay, that's obviously a much shorter term memory, and that's highly likely to be stored in electrical, sort of electrochemical sense. It pretty much has to be. Okay, and there's also, I mean, I don't have to get into it now, but there's memory that you can access, okay, in the sense that you know that you know it, and you can get to it, and you can talk about it. Mm-hmm. And then there has to be some of this other memory that's there. It influences how you behave, but you're not conscious of having acquired it, and you're certainly not capable of getting to it in any conscious way. So there are many different types of memory.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll ask a follow-up on that, but first let's go to our next caller. This is a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
I remember hearing somebody talking about when they first started working with magnetic imaging of the brain, that there were some mishaps, and that I believe it was something like the experimenters experienced some amnesia or bright images, hallucinations, kind of. Do you know anything about that?
The only thing that I can think of, and I don't know if this is what you meant, but there is an approach which is called magnetic stimulation. So it's a totally different technique. And this is one where you actually, from the outside, okay, send a signal, which is a magnetic signal, that stimulates part of the cortex. That's the attempt. What you're trying to do is you put it over particular locations, and you stimulate the brain from the outside. And you can try to stimulate the auditory cortex or the visual cortex, or it was most routinely used in actually to stimulate motor cortex, because you can use it to figure out if there are problems in the motor system. And that type of stimulation, if you don't control sort of how strong it is, and you don't control the frequency with which you do it. So you know, you start stimulate and you do it too fast, you can drive the system in such a way so that it will, in fact, it could be problematic, particularly for individuals who might be prone to having epileptic seizures in the first place. That I do know. It's called transcortical magnetic stimulation.
Yeah, actually, that's one of the things I was going to ask you about, because I understand they found that it can replace electroshock therapy to a certain extent, and it helps people who are in depressed states in the same way that electroshock therapy
mm-hmm,
used
mm-hmm.
to. Only apparently it's a lot less invasive.
Right. I think it is. Well, it is a lot less invasive. And I think that they've come a long way since those days when they first, because you just have to do these things. I know that the original experiments, many of the experimenters did it on themselves, because they didn't apply it to human subjects before they knew that it was safe, and before the, you know, sort of internal review boards gave actually permission to do it, and they had to determine all of the parameters. But I think these days, insofar as it's done in the appropriate places, it's pretty safe.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is I read recently when I heard you were coming on, that I kind of looked through my articles I've kept on.
So even our listeners do their homework. That's great.
A little bit. And it said something about the that recently they had done a in-depth study of the real differences between humans and other primates. And they said that there was, and I couldn't find this darn article, but it said something like one of the differences, some guy called Preuss, I think is his name, the guy that found it, one of the big differences was this particular area of a brain devoted to analyzing rapidly changing stimuli, which I thought was kind of an odd difference between us and primates. And he called it something like an M channel or something like that. Can you speak to that at all, or is that, you know, something not really in your field?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know. I don't know that particular finding. So I don't know or that individual. I do know.
He said something about. He said that because there's such a difference between the other primates and us, that when it comes to dyslexia, that some of our models are incorrect because we've been using monkeys, and we shouldn't have been because the human brain is actually has its a very highly developed organ sort of to process quickly changing stimuli, apparently like reading would induce.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Like I say, I don't know that particular finding. I mean, maybe he's talking. There is a division in the visual system where there's a distinction between magnocellular and parvocellular, and they do differ in sort of speed of processing.
That was the word. That was the word, magnocellular.
Yeah, yeah. It's a particular type of cell. I don't know that anybody. I didn't realize that anybody had looked at it in animals. And there are suggestions, at least by some researchers, that there are differences in the sort of proportion of these types of cells that differ for dyslexics versus, normally reading individuals. Certainly, in all of the sensory systems, there are differences between cells that deal with transients, that is very fast changing stimuli, and ones that deal with sustained activity. And transients are very important, the ability to do that quickly, because, for example, in speech, okay, you don't hear it, but the differences between very, good. Well, I have to think of bad and gad. Okay, the differences between the B and the G and the D and the consonants are just very fast transitions. Okay, fast enough so that it's been found that a number of children with learning disabilities actually have trouble appreciating those fast transitions, which you need in order to be able to appreciate consonants. And in fact, that is a difference between humans and probably even chimpanzees. And I shouldn't quite say it like that, but the what's interesting is there is a number of experimenters I think Mersnick and Paula Talal who have looked at what you do if you present to children who have language disabilities, learning disabilities, present the very same words but just slowed down. Okay, so instead of presenting it at a normal rate, you stretch it out so that they don't have to deal with fast transitions. And in a few cases, they've shown that helps, okay? So maybe that's the sort of...
I use that technique when I speak to conservatives.
Well, everybody tries to, we do it, they call it motherese with children, you tend to slow down and enunciate everything very carefully.
I had to throw that in. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for the call. We just have about 3 minutes left, and there's a whole lot of things that I could ask about in my clumsy way. But There's one thing that I wanted to follow up on. We were talking earlier about, you know, when you're doing these measurements of electrical activity, and a sentence that makes sense is presented in a sentence that doesn't make sense with the word dog at the end of "I take my coffee with cream and dog," you get a different measure or a different signal. And it seems to me, I wonder if this might have some interesting implications for education and learning, because if you're getting consistent signs that someone, that this a sentence is making sense to somebody, it would seem to me that you could use that to measure how someone learns. Or is that
no? Absolutely, naive notion? I think it's not a naive notion at all. Yeah. I think that those are the sorts of, but of course, there are other ways to determine whether somebody's learning something. So the question is whether it's a cost-effective way of doing it. And there can be situations, I think, where it can be cost-effective. I mean, it certainly could be at one level. This is not for learning. But, you know, there are, unfortunately, people who sometimes find themselves in a situation where they're paralyzed or, you know, it's impossible to talk to them. So now if you want to know, okay, are they understanding? Okay, this is certainly one way of getting some indication of that. There are children who may have, you know, speaking problems. And again, this may be a way of determining, you know, is the information getting in and is it making sense? So there are probably some populations better than other, or you might have, you know, patients with probable Alzheimer's, but you don't know. Do they have Alzheimer's? Do they have depression? You know, are they not responding? For what reason are they not responding? Are they really not understanding? So those are situations where you can imagine that this is a way to tap into it. But it's also the case that, I mean, one of the things that I've learned over the years is that what people know, okay, is not always what they can talk about. And if you want to know both what they say and what they really know, you sort of have to look both on the outside and on the inside, because those are providing different measures. And so in that sense, I think that it can be useful even in an educational sense. There's some interesting work that's been done by Lee Osterhout at the University of Washington, where he's looked to see changes as people learn a second language. And there's an indication that the brain waves are showing you an appreciation of the language well before the person actually is doing very well on the tests.
Very interesting. Well, there's much more we could talk about, but perhaps that's a good sample of some of the things that you'll talk about tonight. And we'll just mention again, our guest Marta Kutis will be speaking tonight at the Beckman Institute Auditorium. That's on the corner of Matthews and University. Very large building. You really can't miss it. In Urbana, 8 o'clock in the Beckman Auditorium. And this is also the annual Lyle Lanier Lecture, entitled From Senses to Sense, an Electrophysiological View on the Human Brain Activities. Thanks very much for being here. It's been very
Thank
interesting.
You.